know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk!
What's up, posers? Welcome to Punk Lotto Pod. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley. Dylan's not with me today because I'm on vacation. And last week, Dylan was in L.A. looking for apartments, so we haven't really had a lot of time to record this week's episode. So we thought we'd do something a little special. For today's episode, what we're doing is we're posting one of our weekly bonus audio that you can get over on our Patreon. We decided to share our starting five for the year 1980. This is a unique gimmick that we've yet to do on the main show. It's primarily a Patreon-only feature right now. And if you enjoy what you hear today, you can head over to the Patreon. That's patreon.com/punklottopod. And for $1, you can get access to all of our bonus audio, as well as whatever blog posts and secret playlists that Dylan puts together for us. You can also contribute $10 to the Patreon and choose what album we talk about on the show. And this will be a main episode as well, not just a Patreon-exclusive audio. So yeah, please head over to the Patreon, check that out. Hopefully you'll enjoy today's episode and encourage you to check out the Patreon. Thank you so much. You can find us on all forms of social media, Punk Lotto Pod, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We're punklottopod@gmail.com. And we have a voicemail. It's 202-688-PUNK. And enjoy the show. Hello, Patreon patrons. Dylan's staring at his phone. I'm trying to catch him off guard. What are you doing, making notes?
Nope. Looking at Instagram.
Welcome to the $1 bonus audio tier. We're going to do a starting five. I like these.
These are easy.
Well, honestly, they're all easy, just some take longer than others. Like, the charts take a while to do, and the 5x5s, I think, take the longest, because we actually talk more in depth about what we listen to, but...
Well, yeah, if I'm obligated to make my 5x5s interesting to our listeners, then it is more work, because then I have to listen to, like, 25 records.
So we only do one of those a month.
I've got a stack of them right now. Of good ones.
You could always just save one. Like, screen grab, artificially save a 5x5 for the future.
Just lie.
Yep, this is what it was due this week. Certainly not 2 weeks ago.
These go up 2 weeks late anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. So, who wants to go first?
Making plans on the pod.
5x5 is where we... we're going to do 1980. This corresponds with the episode with Alicia from Ganser. Where we talked about
the Cramps.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot that.
You said something on the episode about, you were talking about Link Wray, and you said that the Cramps did an Ace of Spades riff, but you kept talking about Link Wray.
Yeah. Link Wray has a song called Ace of Spades.
Okay. I was like, are you getting Link Wray and Motorhead mixed up?
No.
Because Ace of Spades came out in the same year.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
No, it's the main guitar lead in that song. It's from a Link Wray song called Ace of Spades. Okay. Very famous lead. You'd recognize it.
Yeah, probably. I thought that might be it, but I was just like, it was just confusing because I had listened to like at least half of Ace of Spades this week, the Motorhead album.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, rips.
Yeah.
That's
I don't know if that's Motorhead news, but. Motorhead has so many albums, I never know which ones are considered the good ones.
I think Overdrive. It's the ones that have big singles from them.
Is that really all it takes?
Like, it's the ones where it's like, oh yeah, I know that song.
So it's just Ace of Spades and Overdrive.
Yeah, pretty much.
Even though on a weaker Motorhead record, there's still some jams on there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, all of the deep cuts are just, like, just as good as, or, like, 9/10 as good as the singles.
Their full albums just aren't essential listening.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about Motorhead. We're talking about other albums that came out in 1980. We call this our starting five.
It's just five recommendations, I guess, is really all it is. And kind of like off of the traditional well-known picks. I mean, some of these are well-known, but like...
Yeah, mine is... Well, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I feel like I have only one really obvious pick on mine.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah, I think mine are just like... Oh, yeah, that one came out, too. It's a good one. It's how similar but equal. Was there? Wait, similar and equal are the same thing. Different but similar.
The same but different.
Yeah. Who's going first?
You go first.
I always go first.
Your show.
All right. Up first, I picked Adam and the Ants, Kings of the Wild Frontier. Have we talked a lot about Adam Ant and Adam and the Ants?
I feel like we mention Adam Ant a lot, especially in like Hades stuff. I feel like we've probably most significantly talked about Adam Ant with Anne.
Yeah.
Just because I think she's like one of the only people that we've had on our show that is also a fan of Adam Ant. So.
Right. Yeah, I can't name anyone else who's even a fan of Adam Ant that's not my parents. So it's probably why we're fans. Yeah, Kings of the Wild Frontier is the second album by the English New Wave. I'm just reading the Wikipedia. New Wave band Adam and the Ants. Released on CBS Records. If you're not familiar with the name, what's the most like prominent pop culture? Is it Goody Two Shoes being on Hot Fuzz at the beginning?
There's that. I mean, if you're a punk, you probably know Beat My Guest is in SLC Punk.
Oh yeah.
I want to say there's like a Family Guy reference to Adam Ant, like where they dress up in the costumes. That's probably the most people just kind of vaguely know of Adam Ant as being like a British 80s new wave, like kind of in the same. I feel like, yeah, I would say that the mainstream culture probably sees Adam Ant as a new romantic band.
Yeah, definitely with the fashion.
Yeah, stylistically, like aesthetically, yeah, definitely. They definitely fit in with the new romantics, but. I mean, musically, at this point, on this record, probably is not too far from, like, Duran Duran.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever listened to any early Adam Ant records, the thing you'll notice is the drumming. They have these very, like, tribal-y sounding drums. It's very much a all on the toms. Like, they only played the toms, almost. Little marching-style drumming.
A lot of vocal chants.
Yeah, a lot of vocal chants and harmonies and just like vocal ad libs, is that what you would call it? Where you're just kind of like doing sounds, so you're not necessarily like saying a word, or you're just iterating on a word until it doesn't sound like the word anymore.
Scatting. I mean, I guess it would be scatting.
More yodeling than scatting.
Yeah. Same mentality, though.
Yeah. Oh, I love this record, though. This is probably my favorite. I mean, Prince Charming was the first record, but I think I like Kings of the... No, Prince Charming is his third record. Yeah, so I like this one more than Prince Charming. Dirk Wears White Sox is the first record, and it's only got a couple tracks I really, really love. This record has Dog Eat Dog, which is, I guess, like, the biggest song. And then Kings of the Wild Frontier, the title track. Ant Music was, like, a big single in the UK. I don't think it really crossed over here.
Yeah.
Ant Music's, out of the singles, probably one of my lesser. Is that the one where he's trying to... No, he's not rapping on that one. There's another song he has on the later record where he sounds like he's trying to rap.
I think it's called Ant Rap.
Yeah.
But yeah. Adam Ant is interesting because he's trying to do something unique, and it is unique,
mm-hmm.
but it's also kind of really corny. But I like it. Like, it's a good kind of corny. It's fun. It's silly. He's a little too silly. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
People don't want to put them, people don't want to claim, punks don't want to claim them because I guess it's barely punk.
Yeah.
But also, like, it was just too playful and childish. But I don't know. I mean, 1980, there's some playful stuff. I mean, Devo, B-52s.
I think the connection to Malcolm McLaren is probably worth mentioning. Because he stole his backing band from Dirk Wears White Sox. And so this is a whole new backing band. Which I think it worked out better. Because this band is better. Or that band went on to be Bow Wow Wow. So, you know.
Yeah.
I Want Candy. Is that their song? They may be more known in the pop culture, but I think Adamant probably has a more dedicated fan base than Bow Wow Wow. It's a really fun record. I really like it. You'll know if you don't like it. Listen to Dog Eat Dog is the first track. If you don't like it, you're not going to like the record.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty much the rest of that.
Yeah. There's not really a lot of surprises.
No, not really.
There.
All right, that's mine. Now, what's yours?
You mentioned the tom drums on the Adam Ant record, so I'm going to talk about a very drum-focused record, and it's the Feelies and their first album, Crazy Rhythms. This record, we talked about 1980. I don't know what record we were talking about. It was probably like 2 years ago, though. And I was looking at the charts, and I saw this record, and I listened to it, because I was just like, it's a 1980 post-punk band. I know the name, the Feelies. I know they're associated with, like, Jangle Pop, and I listened to it, and I was like, holy shit. This is, like, Talking Heads and Wire and, like, almost, like, I'm trying to think of what to compare it to. It's almost like a predecessor to stuff that didn't happen until, like, 20 years after this record. It's a really wild record, like catchy, dancey, but also kind of like weird and aloof and alien sounding. This record coming out in the same year as Remain in Light feels pretty significant. Which, speaking of Remain in Light, I listened to that record again this week, and that A side is super fun. And then the B side is where it really loses. Like, the last half of the B side is just like all of the most Eno-y droning stuff. but this Feelies record is probably similar to the A side of Talking Heads record in a lot of ways, except it's more consistent. Doesn't drop off on the last half, last quarter. Yeah, I mean, the Feelies would stop after this. Like, I feel like they didn't do anything for like four or five years after this record until their next record came out, which I think was The Good Earth, which I talked about on our 100 and 100. And that's, you can see how it's the same musicians, but it's such a stylistic departure from this record. They really strip away a lot of the like punk elements other than like kind of some of the faster rhythms. But yeah, this is just a good toe tapping, fun record.
Yeah, I didn't get...
Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't get a chance to listen to any of your picks before. This week has been a lot of fun for me. So yeah, I didn't get a chance to like reevaluate some of your picks. My memory of the Feelies album is that it's good.
It's a Stiff record. I always forget that this came out on Stiff Records, which Stiff Records kind of, okay, they ran until 86. I'm trying to think of what else they put out at this time. They did stuff with like Nick Lowe and the Damned. Elvis Costello. So yeah, that makes sense next to this Feelies record. But it's an interesting record because they were kind of trying to respond to punk music when they made it. Like, they were older and they were like seeing punk music happening and saying, let's try that. And they actually did a good job of doing that and doing something different with it. So rather than being like, oh, that's the next trend, let's do that.
Yeah, like so many of the other old guys did.
They were just like, oh, that's interesting. Here's something that we can do with that. That's also interesting and is its own thing.
Is this record considered jangle pop?
I wouldn't outright call it jangle pop, but it's definitely pretty jangly, and you can definitely tell that it was influential to like REM and maybe even the Smiths, but I don't know. I feel like the Smiths try to pretend like they popped up out of thin air.
I was going to say that this record always makes me think that this, to me, feels like the earliest indie band. You know, like they've got even their look isn't very punk. They're kind of just normal looking people.
They look like, I mean, they're standing, it's like from their busts, basically, their shoulders and heads. Against the blue background, they look like Weezer.
Yeah, like it seems very much like this is like the spiritual earliest incarnation of indie rock.
Yeah,
because I could see it taking an influence on jangle pop, and then because that's the arc. It goes from like punk to post punk to jangle pop to then like college rock,
yeah,
alternative rock, then indie rock. So like that's the lineage. So yeah,
I like yeah, that. they're cheap trick fans doing subdued punk.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I got on that one.
Okay. All right. Up next, you mentioned them. I've got the Damned's The Black Album. I for a while now have been a steady champion of the middle period of the Damned, I guess you could say. The post Machine Gun Etiquette, pre Phantasmagoria era of the Damned. So like it's still a lot of the original team members, a lot of the original band members. It's like the X-Men. The Damned probably are the most like the X-Men out of the punk bands, with Captain Sensible and Dave Vanian as your leads. This album also has Rat Scabies on drums and Paul Gray on bass. This is Paul Gray's first record with the band, and he would stay with them for a while. The general consensus on the Damned is Damn is a classic of 77 punk, a landmark record. Another Music from Another Planet, is that what it's called, is terrible.
Music from Another Room.
Yeah.
That was them going, let's do post-punk.
Yeah. And then them coming, and Machine Gun Etiquette is kind of like the fan favorite record. Like, if you're a Damned fan, you're probably going to say it's your favorite for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, it was the, yeah, they were like, no, let's go back and do what worked, except we're better musicians now.
Yeah. And, you know, that's got, you know, some absolute classic moments. It's the critically acclaimed record.
Yeah.
So I've always been a fan of the two records that came out right before Phantasmagoria, which was their shift into the full goth rock thing. The Black Album is kind of like the real beginnings of that. It's a double LP. Side three is entirely one track called Curtain Call. Side four is just live music, so they could, you know, a live set, so they could justify, you know, making it a three LP or two LP record. You didn't have a blank side because they didn't do that back then. And it is awesome. It's so good. So this record and Strawberries are the two that like people just kind of ignore, probably because everybody sees where they're going with their sound, and so nobody wants to really dive into it. But I really, really love this record. I think it's a really great underrated punk record in a time where there weren't a ton of like punk bands not doing post-punk.
Yeah. Yeah, because when the records that we mostly talked about on the main episode were all trying to do something else. Like, like either they're post-punk records or they were trying to do like something artier.
I mean, the Black Album is a little self-indulgent, you know, the choice to make it have like a 13-minute track as your closer on a double LP. It's kind of indulgent. They were trying to do something, maybe more of like an aesthetic or conceptual thing, because the music itself is still pretty straightforward Damned at this point. They experiment, of course, but not to the degree of Phantasmagoria. I recommend this album if you are a fan of the first two Damned records and have, or not first, you know, Machine Gun Etiquette and Damn, and haven't really dove into the later stuff because you didn't like the Phantasmagoria sound.
I liked Phantasmagoria. I haven't really listened to the Black Album or Strawberries. Like, I've heard stuff from it, but I haven't really like listened to them properly.
You should, because they're, it may be blasphemy to say they're better than Damn, but they're more interesting.
I can see that.
Interesting, and they're better musicians.
Like, Damned is a really good record that is made better by it being a really important record. But yeah, I could definitely see how someone could say that the Black Album or Strawberries are like critically better records.
Yeah, but that's all I have to say about the Damned.
My next record, I was trying to think of how to tie these all together. I mentioned on the main episode how basically all of my choices for this Patreon very much tie into that throwback 50s, 60s rock and roll, like rockabilly and garage rock. Like that Feelies record has like definitely has like a Buddy Holly kind of nerd rock energy, and they have the Peggy Sue Tom sound. The Pretenders self-titled record very much fits in like the same kind of power pop, pulling from oldies rock and roll. The Pretenders are a band, especially on this record, that their lead singles don't do a good job of portraying what they actually sound like. I know, Justin, you don't like Chain Gang.
No, I hate that song. That's like, that's one of those songs that just like gets underneath my skin. It's nails on chalkboard to me. It is the same saccharine type melodies that I don't like that Cheap Trick does too.
This record, their self-titled record, their first album, starts off with Precious, which is just a kick-ass song. Like, killer riffs. I love the way she says fuck off in the bridge. Really cool guitar leads. I really, really, really dig the way, what's his name, the lead guitarist in the band, James Honeyman Scott. He has this really cool flanger guitar tone that's just really raw and sounds really, really cool. And that's an effect that is very difficult to make sound cool. I've heard some stuff from across their catalog, and I think that, like, I've heard some stuff from their 1990 record, and it's definitely, like, for 1990, it's weird, but it's good. And then they have some more, like, rockabilly-ish leaning stuff in their later catalog that sounds really cool, too. Like, rockabilly influences without being psychobilly. Like, just genuinely being good at it. This record, the A side, is like mostly hard rock, fast, punky stuff. And then it ends on Stop Your Sobbing, which is a cover of a Kinks song produced by Nick Lowe, who only produced that one song on this record. He did this single and then decided not to keep working with them because he thought they weren't going anywhere. And that song is the most, it really stands out from the rest of the record. I mean, the production styles are drastically different from that song and the rest of the record. So it's, I can imagine how much different this record would have sounded, how much slicker and more polished they would have sounded. And I love Nick Lowe and I like his production, but I don't think he was ultimately the right choice for this band. The B-side gets more, the B-side is interesting because it's got this, got more genre songs, I want to say, genre exercises. It's got the other big single, Brass in Pocket, which is more like Chain Gang, more power pop, radio friendly. I like it more than Chain Gang. I think it's a really good song, but it is definitely slicker. I don't know. It's an interesting record that is not, it's one of those records that you've seen in for like $5 in record stores for years and years and years and years and never listened to it because you just think like, oh yeah, there's that band that has those singles that are whatever.
They're one of those bands that their timing of like when they hit it big was bad because then grunge is right around the corner.
Well, they were early 80s. I mean, they were on the radio in early 80s, but even then they weren't new wave.
No, they were American.
And they're too late for, like, they're kind of too late to be like Blondie contemporaries. And then, yeah, they're not the Smiths.
Yeah.
So they just kind of fall in this weird, like, sort of hard rock, but then not being a hard rock band the way that hard rock bands sounded in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, that actually kind of segues perfectly into my next pick. You mentioned like the 50s, the 60s sound that a lot of the bands were like borrowing from. I picked Joan Jett's self-titled album. And Joan Jett is a musician who also borrows heavily from the 50s and 60s. Very much she's borrowing from her childhood in the same way that the Ramones are borrowing from their childhood, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of covers on this record. So this is the very, very first solo Joan Jett record, released right after the Runaways disbanded. It was self-released. They got rejected by 30-something record labels, which is bonkers.
Yeah, that's wild considering the Runaways were a significant band. I mean, they had at least one pretty big hit.
Yeah. They had multiple albums on labels, you know? You'd think their own labels would just be like, yeah, we'll take a stab at this. Maybe they were just like, she's just gonna, you know, it's just a musician going off on their own. It's not gonna be as good. Joke's on them. Her catalog is far more praised than the Runaways catalog is. Runaways typically have like one album that everybody really, really likes, and the rest are all just considered whatever. Ironically, those are the ones that like Joan kind of fronted those records.
Yeah. Joan is better than Cherry.
Yeah. That's I don't think it's controversial to say that Joan Jett's albums are better than the Runaways albums. I think people...
I feel like it's a comparison that no one actually makes.
Right.
So maybe it kind of has the energy of a hot take, because who's really that invested in saying, well, the Runaways were not as good as Joan Jett and the Blackhearts?
I mean, most likely a really big Joan Jett fan is probably a Runaways fan, too. So it's not an unrealistic expectation. I don't know that there's anybody who's like a really big Runaways fan that's not a Joan Jett fan. That could be the reason why you never see that hot take. But yeah, this is the first record. It was re-released in 1981 as Bad Reputation. I don't understand why those 30 fucking labels turned down this album at all when it starts with Bad Reputation.
Yeah.
Which is like one of the greatest rock songs, period. Like just pure rock and roll fun. You can't beat Bad Reputation.
Yeah, I've been quietly championing Joan Jett for quite a while. I have this theory that Joan Jett is the coolest, probably the coolest person in rock music ever. Like every single picture of Joan Jett I have ever seen from any period of her life is the coolest fucking thing you've ever seen. She just looks badass. And then her voice sounds raw and nasty and cool, and even the way she does, like she's definitely like, it's like the Cramps where like half the catalog is covers, but she makes those covers hers in like almost every case.
Oh yeah, like this record has a Gary Glitter cover, an Isley Brothers cover, she does Woolly Bully. I mean, maybe the labels didn't want it because it was so many covers. I could see that. It's a lot of covers from the 50s and 60s, and the labels are like, no kids are going to want these. Probably took the Ramones blowing up to... the Ramones had already blown up by this point.
Yeah, the Ramones did End of the Century in 1980.
Yeah.
Which is a better record than its reputation, but is an unusual record in their discography. And it's a record that I understand why that's the stopping point for most people with the Ramones, even though like the next four records after that are incredible.
Yeah, Joan Jett is like one of those also like sneaky punks where people don't, I feel like the average person doesn't really associate her with punk music, but she very much at least has the punk attitude.
Well, she produced GI.
Yeah.
And Germs.
Which makes me think, yeah. She's produced like other records that are, there's like on her Wikipedia page, it tells you like the stuff she's worked on, and like I'm just always like, what? Like, when did you do this? Let's see if I can find it. She appears in like a lot of movies too. I'm trying to find the stuff she specifically worked on that was not her own. She was on the 2006 Warped Tour. Oh, she produced the Eyeliners record.
Right.
No Apologies. She worked on a Marky Ramone album.
Yeah.
The Intruders albums. She worked with the Gits after Mia Zapata.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. After she was killed. She even appears on the America's Most Wanted episode. Oh, she produced Circus Lupus in 1992.
Oh, fuck. That's right.
And Bikini Kill in 94.
Yeah.
So, like, she was there. And, like, she's just, like... She's cool, though. Like, she has her own record label called Blackheart Records that's put out records from, like, Metal Church and Big Daddy Kane. Like, she has a varied taste in music. She's smart. She's a good producer. She's probably queer.
She's bi.
She has... I was reading, like, this article, this little section about her personal life, and then she like, did an interview for, like, Out Magazine where she says, I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes. She's like, assume what you want, is what she said. And then, like, later has said in 2006, she's like, I've never made any kind of statement about my personal life on any level. And then,
she has a song called AC/DC that is not about the band.
But then in, like, a 2018, like, interview for New York Times, what is it? They did not want to show her documentary because she wasn't out. There was, like, an LGBT film festival that didn't want to show her movie because she wasn't out.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, they didn't want the movie to come out because I don't declare. And then she's like, apparently is like holding up her necklace. What the fuck is this? Two lebrises or axes crossing each other inside two women's symbols crossing each other. It's not been off since I got it. And I wear this one every day. She lifts up her shirt on her back and reveals a tattoo of similar female symbols on her lower back. She's like, I don't know how much more you can declare. So to me, it sounds like she purposely was like, look, if you don't know, I'm not telling you.
Well, I mean, I think in her defense, she comes from a generation that still struggles, even the most, like, clearly queer people of her generation. Like, it's just, I don't know. You got to cut her some slack. She's probably internalized a lot of shit.
True. I mean, she's how old now?
Yeah.
62. Yeah. anyway, back to this record specifically, though.
And also, I mean, honestly, pressuring people to label their gender and sexuality is kind of a weird thing to do.
Right.
Anyway.
Bad Reputation, or self-titled / Bad Reputation, self-released, then reissued on the actual label because it sold really well in, like, Europe. And so they finally did it. I wanted to mention, though, like, the Her Punk connection. So on this record, Steve Jones and Paul Cook of the Sex Pistols perform just on a couple tracks. Paul actually, like, produces some tracks, track 4 and 11. And then Frank Infante and Clem Burke from Blondie are on a couple tracks on this record, too. So, like, she's friends with the Ramones. She's punk. She's always been punk. I don't know what the deal is with people not really associating her as a punk musician, but she very much is. She has better full albums. I'd say the first Black Hearts album is probably better than this one, which that's the one that I love, Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
Album is good. I mean, really, like, a lot of her 80s material is just really, really good. Glorious Results of Misspent Youth, great. I don't really know good music very well. That's 86. It's probably cool, but it's also going to be like a late 80s record, so it could sound weird. But yeah, listen to Joan Jett if you haven't. If you haven't, that's weird. Listen to an album.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, I definitely had, like, I Love Rock and Roll in my head, you know, and Bad Reputation, like, which I feel like when you listen to those songs in the context of the records, like, especially I Love Rock and Roll, they're way better.
Yeah. I used to be kind of annoyed with I Love Rock and Roll because I don't really love songs that are that pace and, like, very, like, chanty like that. Like a cheer, almost.
Yeah.
But it works. It does. You're right. It works better in the context of the album. Bad Reputation, though, is just killer. Just a fucking killer song.
Yeah.
Your next pick, Dylan.
All right, my next pick is the self-titled album by Rocky Erickson and the Aliens. This is not really a punk record, I'll say that, but very much of interest to punks. Like, you should listen to this record if you like punk music. Rocky Erickson, if you're not familiar, is famous for being the frontman of the 13th Floor Elevators. The songwriter behind You're Gonna Miss Me, which is an incredible song, which I found out this week he wrote when he was 15. Like, one of the best, greatest, I guess you could call it, garage rock songs of all time. One of the best rock songs in general of all time. with his, like, primal scream vocals and wild harmonica. 15 years old. Just unreal. This record came out after it was recorded in 79, and it's kind of his first output after spending a lot of the 70s involuntarily hospitalized. It's really hard to talk about Rocky Erickson without talking about his mental illness. But he's an artist that I listen to his music, and I've gotten really into it in the last few years since he died. I've listened to a few of his records across his discography, and it's all amazing. Like, all of it I've heard is good. Like, some of the production's a little bit weaker on some records, and there's a lot of overlap. A lot of material gets reused because he never really could have a consistent work life as a musician, just due to his, having no access to quality mental health care, basically, his entire life until like the late 90s, 2000s, I think. he got some help from his family. But his music, like, he can be tender and sweet and have like these cute little love songs that have amazing melodies, and then have a record like this where it's like wild rock and roll with killer guitar solos, and the melodies are still every bit as sweet and break your heart, even though he's singing about like vampires and goblins and whatever he's like was fixated on at this time period. Really, yeah, just like I said, break your heart melodies. Like, they're just, I don't know how to describe it. There's just kind of a hint of sadness to all of them. But Rocky was a big influence on the Minutemen. They were big fans of his, which makes a lot of sense because this record was produced by Stu Cook, who was the bass player for CCR, who are also a massive influence on the Minutemen. CCR, the undergirding foundation of punk rock, I think, in a lot of ways, and people don't recognize that necessarily, but yeah, his impact you can definitely feel on this record because it's really well produced, it's really well put together band, and Rocky's voice sounds incredible. But this record kind of overlaps, like I said, there's a lot of overlap in his discography with a 1981 record called The Evil One, which has a lot of the same songs from that 79 recording session. So I'm going with this one as the starting point, just because it did come out first. But you can find that if you look up this record, I think it's titled The Evil One on Spotify, and that is like the reissued collecting all of the songs from that session. So you could almost see it as a double album.
All right, up next, I have Nobody's Heroes by the Stiff Little Fingers. Dylan, you were wearing an Inflammable Materials shirt the day we recorded with Alicia. I love the Stiff Little Fingers. I think ultimately they're like my 77 punk band.
Yeah.
Because like everybody, I think everybody's got theirs, you know, like their personal favorite. And the Ramones don't really count. They're not a 77 punk band. They're from America. It started earlier than that. So like, if we're talking strictly about bands who got big thanks to the 77 punk explosion or formed in the wake of the 77 punk explosion, Stiff Little Fingers are my band for sure. Inflammable Materials is A++, classic status, incredible, iconic, legendary record, front to back bangers. That whole record is amazing. But people tend to overlook the rest of their discography. I'm going to say I've not heard every single Stiff Little Fingers album. There are some very late 80s, early 90s records I've not heard. But out of every single Stiff Little Fingers record I have heard, they're all good. Now, there's a period of albums, specifically Nobody's Heroes and the follow-up record Go For It, that are nearly as good as Inflammable Material. Like, not, I wouldn't say like every single track is a hit like Inflammable Material is, but Nobody's Heroes comes so close to being that good. It's just like, it's, I don't know, you know these songs too, like you'll hear them and you go, oh, I thought that was on Inflammable Material. Mm-hmm. No, it's on Nobody's Heroes. gotta get away feels like it should be on Inflammable Material. Wait and See, Fly the Flag, At the Edge, Nobody's Hero is great. Tin Soldier is the final track on this record. Fucking Tin Soldier, that's a show closer. Yeah. I imagine they probably closed almost every show with that after they wrote it. It's a 4 minute and 46 seconds song, too. There's 3 4-minute tracks on this album. Nobody's Hero and Wait and See are 4 minute plus songs. They're so, so, so good, though. Like,
they do Jake a specials Burns cover on this record.
Yeah, they do. Doesn't make it all right. Jake Burns has one of my favorite voices in punk, especially like this era. because he has like a scratchiness to his voice, but he can really carry a melody, his type of melody. Like, it's definitely the ones that he wrote, but he has these moments of like clarity in his voice that almost come across as like folk singing. But he, to me, he just has one of the coolest voices in like this era of punk.
Yeah, I'm definitely on the same page. Like, when people talk about the Sex Pistols or the Clash, I'm like, no, Stiff Little Fingers. Like, that band, getting into that band when we were first getting into punk, to find so much of what I look for in punk of all eras, like, truly a seminal band to me. Mm-hmm. I'll say, I'd go out on a limb and say they have four full-length records from the first period of their career.
Mm-hmm.
Because Now Then came out in 82, and then the next record doesn't come out until 91. So I would go out on a limb and say that their discography has no, the original portion of their discography has no bad albums. Like, Now Then is the weakest. Yeah. But I've heard it. It's good.
Yeah. I have not heard a lot of the 90s stuff. I'm pretty sure I've heard Flags and Emblems. I don't know if I've heard Get a Life Through Guitar and Drum. I have heard No Going Back, and is great too. Jake's voice isn't as like strong as it used to be. It's actually a little smoother now. I guess he just kind of shredded his voice, so he had to change his singing style so that he could, you know, continue singing.
I can't keep screaming through all of these songs. I need to learn how to sing properly, but oh well, the damage is there, so the voice still sounds husky.
Yeah, it does. No Going Back is a really great record. I remember when it came out in 2014, I was like, this album is really good. Why is no one talk about it? Probably because it's a 2014 record by a 70s punk band.
A legacy punk act reunites, yeah. Puts out records in the later period of the career. Very often they're not good.
And you'd be right to say most are not very good. I need to dig into those 90s ones to see how they stand up. If the 2014 one was, there was enough time, maybe. That could be why that one's that good compared to. That one's also nostalgic, too. That one has, like, callbacks to Flammable Material lines on the record. But actually, interesting. So I'm looking at the Rate Your Music scores for everything they put out, and with the exception of Tinderbox, all the rest have higher scores than No Going Back. So I might like those other ones too. I'll have to give those a shot. And I bet, and Tinderbox is only slightly lower than No Going Back, so it's probably just slightly less better. Well, then I have something to look forward to once I start listening to later SLF records. But yeah, you really cannot go wrong with the first four records in the discography. They had 4 years in a row where they released incredible records. So definitely, if you're familiar with the Flammable Material and you haven't tried any other records, listen to Nobody's Heroes, because it's nearly as good.
It's funny, 1980 has two very important records to me, with songs about being an alien and an outsider and a freak and scary shit. The other one is, this is probably my most obvious choice. If I were looking at the 1980 charts as a guest picking a record, this is probably the one I would pick. But it's Is This Real by the Wipers. Fucking love Greg Sage. Just full stop, flawless discography. Like, everything I've heard is good. His solo stuff, later Wipers stuff. They sound a little weird because it's like weird production, but the songs are good, man. And that guitar playing. Like, this record has so many riffs that John Reese has like almost directly lifted on Jehu and Rocket and Hot Snakes records. This is a perfect record. There's no skips. I mean, I'm not like a skips guy anyway. Very rarely do I actually skip songs on albums when I listen to full albums, but none of these songs drag for me. Like, I want to sing along with every word of this record, which is fun because I can very easily sing along with this whole record. Greg's voice is like clean, but yelling, and he really doesn't like sing pretty. Like, he's really not a good singer, technically speaking, but his voice is really strong and it cuts through really nicely. Again, lots of rock and roll influence, lots of classic garage rock influence. Greg Sage, I'm 100% sure, was a 13th Floor Elevators fan. Definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Directly probably influenced by Rocky Erickson. So
yeah,
it felt like a logical progression to talk about this record from that one. And in turn, the Wipers were a direct influence on the Minutemen, too. Yeah, we've talked about the Wipers before, so I don't have to really labor on them. But this is the second time I've listened to this record in the last month. I just randomly felt like listening to it like a month ago. And then when we were looking at these charts, I was like, well, I'm definitely going to do that one. So,
all right. My final choice was almost one of your choices. It is Too Much Pressure by The Selector.
It was like the first one I put on my list.
Yeah. It's so funny because, like, when I was compiling my list, here's what I had on my list that I didn't pick, that I was like, was going to choose from. So I had X is Los Angeles. I thought it was a little obvious of a pick, so I kind of skipped that one. The Jam sound effects probably would have made the cut if I didn't find this one. But even I had some weirdos choices. Like, I threw in Dire Straits Making Movies and Dexy's Midnight Runners Searching for the Young Soul Rebels. Like the pre Come On Eileen, where they were still a punk band.
I have a Dire Straits on my not punk section.
Like, I got a Thin Lizzy record on here, but I have not listened to that one, so I couldn't really say for sure if it's good or not. So then I was getting into, I saw the specials, or at least more specials. I was like, oh, that'd be a good one to consider. And then I was like, wait, did Jimmy Cliff put out anything in 1980? And he did. I Am the Living, good record. Not my favorite Jimmy Cliff. And then I saw that Madness had an album too. I think it was their second album.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm like, I feel like I'm missing something. For some reason, The Selector didn't show up on the punk charts. I think I found them on an overall. So I'm going through the overall list and I'm like, God damn it. Too Much Pressure. Like, I saw it and I was like, that's the pick. That's like, I wanted a ska representative or a two-tone representative for this list. And the second I saw the Too Much Pressure was on there, I was like, there it is. That's the pick.
It's so much better than More Specials.
It is. It is. It really is. It's not. Is that a hot take? I don't think it's a hot take.
No, I don't think so.
The Specials discography is
like, I don't think,
mixed bag.
I don't think Too Much Pressure is better than the first Specials record.
No.
But it's definitely better than anything else the Specials did.
Yeah, they never really recaptured that magic on record. Live, they probably did, but like, that first Specials record is like the only essential Specials listening, I think. Because then, like, The Selector and The English Beat come along and they kind of take that sound and run with it way further. Though, really, Too Much Pressure, they only released two albums in the 80s, The Selector. They would come back in the 90s. They would come back in the 90s during the ska, third wave ska explosion. And then they spent a good chunk of the 90s just doing covers. They did like these Trojan Songbook albums that are just like them doing classics. They have some acoustic records. They have a couple acoustic records. It doesn't take until like 2011 when they do like a whole new LP. I think they came back and did two new LPs in the very early 90s, but everything after that's covers until like 2011. God, this record is just too good and too danceable, you know? It's one that makes you just want to like start dancing around while you're listening to it. The whole record is just like upbeat, fun records. It has a lot of covers on here too, but there are, I mean, that's what ska does. Ska does plenty of covers. Yeah, I remember stumbling across this record. Actually, you know what? I want to say it was at Earshot in Winston is where I bought this record. But prior to my purchasing it, I had never listened to The Selector before. All I knew is when I was going through the used record section, I saw this checkerboard border, a person wearing a suit on the cover. And like, I knew I'd seen the name The Selector, but I was like, I'm buying this record. It says two-tone in the corner. I'm buying this record right now. I've not heard it. I don't know what it sounds like. I'm buying it because it's the most two-tone ska record you could possibly have found out of nowhere. And I went home and put it on and I was like, this is incredible. 10 years ago at this point, but we're close to it.
Yeah, this this record is so good. I'm going to look at the track listing. Right, right. It starts with 3 Minute Hero.
Mm-hmm.
A-side is just kick ass. And then the B-side, what does it start with? Too Much Pressure? The
yes, title the track? A-side. Yeah,
it's on the B-side. It's on the B-side. And then Murder. Murder! It doesn't let up. It's such a good record. Pauline's voice is incredible. She really, really, really deserves to be talked about by name often in punk history.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a very, very cool figure in ska and punk England. Highly, highly recommend you check this record out. What are you wrapping us up with? As if I don't know.
I'm closing it out, taking it home with the boss. I knew I had to put this record on here. Bruce has probably 4 records that punks should be aware of. I'm not saying you have to be a Bruce fan. It's fine. He's divisive. I get it. If you don't like his voice, you're not gonna like it. It's, I mean,
is he that divisive?
I don't know. People wanna hate him because he's an old boomer rocker, but I don't know. And if you hated, like, if you were just like one of those people that hated like the whole Gaslight Anthem, Menzinger's
Hold Steady
Bruce thing mania that happened,
Bruce-a-mania.
But this record, first 4 songs on that A side, it's just has all of the urgency and energy and punch of a classic punk record. I mean, The Ties That Bind is just a classic anthem. Sherry Darling is sassy and fun. Jackson Cage is a crusher with a killer riff and just some heavy ass lyrics. Two Hearts could have been a Ramon single. This record also includes Hungry Heart, which almost was a Ramon single because he was gonna give it to them and then changed his mind. I think probably because his manager was like, the last 2 songs that you gave away became huge hits.
Who did he give them to? Who are the other ones he gave to?
He gave Because the Night to Patti Smith. And yeah. It was like her one hit.
Yeah. Mainstream hit, yeah.
Yeah.
Crossover success.
Which they talked to her on the Making of the Darkness documentary. And she's so charming when she talks about that song. If you can find just that clip, I don't know if you can. If I can find it, I'll post it to watch, just because the way she talks about it is really, really... I love the way she talks about it. But Hungry Heart actually became one of his big hits. Like, it was his first real hit. Because Morning the Run was, like, as an album was successful and really critically regarded, but it really wasn't charting well. I want to say Hungry Heart actually hit, like, the top 10.
I'm just imagining Joey singing that song now.
Yeah.
Gonna have a hungry heart. They could do it.
Met her in a King Tambor.
Speed up a little bit, but yeah.
It's a double album, which a lot of people might say that there's a lot of material here that is very inessential, but I don't care how dumb you think Cadillac Ranch is. It's not a song about cars. It's a song about mortality. But yeah, I mean, I'm a Rocker is just a goofy song where he's talking about having a, like, a Dick Tracy watch or whatever. Mentioning Kojak. But I mean, there's some more ballady material that are all-time Bruce ballads. The River, the title track. I love Stolen Car. Really, really love that song. Just this, like, kind of brooding ballad about a guy who is realizing that his marriage is empty and loveless, so he's driving around going out at night and stealing cars, trying to get arrested so he can get out of his marriage.
Sounds like a movie.
Yeah. Anyway, this is the record. I wanted to talk about this record because we've talked about my love of Bruce many times on the show, and we don't really get into it much because it's not really relevant. But this record, I wanted to talk about it because this is the only opportunity I probably will ever get to. It's the record that really made me a Bruce fan, because I wasn't into him, and I knew he was an influence on Gaslight Anthem and Hot Water Music and Against Me and plenty of other punk bands at that time when I was getting into punk. So my conversion to full-on Bruce fan is kind of in step with my full alignment as a punk, as a college kid. So I kind of just like, I listened to, bought like a dollar copy of Born in the USA, and then like I went back and listened to Born to Run because I knew it was a classic, and I was like, all right, there's enough there. I'll start at the beginning of his discography, and then I kind of worked from there, and I got up to this record, and I'm like, holy shit, I love this guy. So anyway, I saw him. The only time I've seen him in concert was on the album anniversary tour a few years ago. So this one's always going to be my favorite, even if it's not technically his best.
All right, that will do it. Thank you so much, patrons. I really like doing these. They're less work than like a regular episode is, but like it feels easier to get dive in on these when it's just purely just like, oh yeah, I like this record and here's why I like it.
Yeah. We get to talk about records we already know.
Yeah. That our guests probably aren't gonna pick.
Yeah.
Or if they do, I mean I would be happy if anybody picked any of these records and we like truly did a deep dive on them and we could talk about them song by song and stuff like that. But yeah, it's fun. I hope you enjoy it like we do. But that'll do it for us this week. See you later.